of tinder walking that far with a half-healed foot. And that's if you go straight through Superior. How did you plan to do that if you're so worried about being spotted?
I don't know, Edgar wrote. We'll figure out something.
Look, Henry said, if you're dead set on this, let me drive you as far as the border. I know the back roads around here. We can stay off the main highways. I can even get us around Superior. Then it's a straight shot up the North Shore Highway.
Let me see that map, Edgar signed. He traced out the route for himself, but there was no real choice. Henry could jump them ahead by weeks in a single day. Once near the border, they could choose a likely spot and continue on foot. After that, they both guessed 5 more days walking to Thunder Bay, 10 if he babied Tinder. In truth, accepting Henry's offer looked like the only way Starchild was reachable.
Okay, Edgar signed, but we leave tomorrow.
He waited until Henry was asleep that night and walked to the shed and opened the doors. He squeezed his way along the fender of the Skyliner and hiked himself over the door and sat in the driver's seat and rested his palms on the fluted ring of the steering wheel. In the dark, he could barely see his hands.
Are you there? He signed.
He waited. A long silence followed. After a time, he decided it was no use, and he started to go back to the house. Then he told himself it wouldn't hurt to try anyway. He lifted his hands in the dark.
Did you see that thing in me?
He signed.
That rare thing?
In the morning, Edgar calmed the dogs by running exercises in the yard, fetches, come-fors, heels. They had stayed so long with Henry, the dogs were lax about sticking near him. And now that they were heading out again, they would need those skills. Henry called in sick to work, coughing weakly into the telephone receiver and grinning at Edgar. They left just after 10 o'clock, when Henry guessed traffic would be lightest. Tinder sat up front, but Edgar stayed in back with Essay and Babu and a set of blankets, trying to shake off his jitters. He downed the dogs and drew the blankets over them whenever a car came into view. Henry was quiet. He lay his arm across the front seat and rested a hand on Tinder's shoulder. After an hour, they were west of Brule. Henry cut across Highway 2. He had a spot in mind, he said, where they could stop, give the dogs a break. A little cove he and Belva had discovered while exploring the coastline.
Keep going, Edgar signed. They don't need it.
Are you kidding? Henry said. These dogs are pee machines. I don't want to find out what it's like to wipe that out of the nooks and crannies of my fine vinyl seats. Essay seemed to sense an opportunity. She peered into Edgar's face and breathed anxiously.
Stop it, he signed. You're going to get us in trouble.
When they left Henry's little valley, the sun was shining between sparse white clouds. But as they approached Lake Superior, the clouds merged into the solid blue mass of a storm front. By the time Henry arrived at the turnout and killed the engine, the sun had been eclipsed by the advancing storm. Henry climbed out of the car. Edgar sat in the back seat, looking up and down the road for traffic.
Relax, Henry said, knocking on the side window. Don't you want to see the lake? Look around, no one's here.
Henry was right, but the thought of standing in the open with all 3 dogs made him edgy. He'd spent whatever luck he had. On the other hand, the weather was turning ugly, so there was little chance they'd linger. And it would be harder to let the dogs out in the rain.
See? Henry said. Nobody for miles. You'll like this. Follow me.
He led them through stands of scrub pine and maple on a faint trail. The trees were slick with green moss and the ground slippery, and made all the more treacherous by the storm gusts that had begun lashing the underbrush. The air was filled with the scent of the lake. Even before Edgar glimpsed water, he heard the smashing of waves against the shore. They emerged near a secluded cove, not much bigger than Henry's yard. At the back stood a sheer rock wall, 20 or 30 feet high, forming an irregular curve covered with gray ledges and pocked with erosion holes, some so big they looked like caves. A colony of water birds squawked and flapped near the top, where a shag of turf and tree roots overhung the rock. Edgar saw at once why Henry liked the spot. On a sunny day, it would have felt cozy and secluded, a place where Edgar could have relaxed and watched the flat, watery horizon without fear of being spotted. Up and down the coastline, all he could see were trees on rocky cliffs. No houses, no roads, not even boats on the water. As Edgar and Henry picked their way down the last few feet of trail, the dogs bounded onto the driftwood-strewn beach. Out on the lake, the water beneath the storm had turned black and choppy. A thread of lightning flickered between the sky and the water. When Tinder paused to lift his leg against one of the larger chunks of driftwood, Henry gave Edgar one of his significant looks. The dog was only scent marking, but Henry took it as vindication that the dogs indeed needed a break. "I told you, don't feel bad. You just have to know how to read them," he said modestly. "If you were staying around longer, I could teach you how I know these things. People think it takes some special talent, but I tell them..." Then his mouth dropped open, and he lifted his hand to point. Something was happening out on the lake. In the time it had taken them to walk onto the beach, the storm front had lowered, blackened, began to roll over itself. What looked like a puff of steam jumped off the water, disappeared, then formed again. "Tornado," Henry said. "Waterspout, I mean. Oh, Jesus Christ, look at that." Edgar turned and was instantly riveted at the sight. As the funnel drew water up from the lake, it resolved, bottom to top, translucent at first, then white, then gray. Two more funnels appeared behind the first, woolly tubes dropping from the clouds. A chest-rattling thrum reached them. The dogs looked up, hackles raised. "This is not good," Henry said. "I don't like this." Somehow the three funnels gave the impression of standing still and hurtling forward at the same time. Edgar felt no impulse to run or hide or do anything but watch. The most distant of the three was nothing more than a sinuous thread coiling over the water. The one nearest to shore, maybe a mile away, had thickened into a sturdy vortex that narrowed to a point at the water's surface. All three were heading east, across the lake. If they kept going, they would pass in front of the cove, though not by much. He stood wondering if the storm that had corkscrewed the boards on their barn roof had birthed funnels like these. Henry shared no part of Edgar's fascination. He turned to the steep trail leading into the woods, trotted a few feet, slipped, stood, and turned around. No, we ought to find cover. We don't want to be in a car if they come this way," he said. "They say to find a culvert if you can." He surveyed their surroundings and the rock wall curving behind them. "Let's get into one of those caves," he said. "There's no time for anything else." The center funnel lifted off the lake. It was close enough that it seemed to slam against the water when it came down again. Just moments earlier, it had looked broad and sluggish. Now it was more compact, as though drawing itself inward, spinning faster, and the noise of it was suddenly very loud. "Nat," Henry said. "Nat, are you paying attention? We need to get out of the open, now." Reluctantly, Edgar tore his gaze away from the water. He clapped and recalled the dogs as the first real blast of wind caught him flat against his back. He stumbled and almost pitched forward. By the time he'd gotten the dogs together, Henry stood waiting at the rock wall.
"Here and here," Henry said, pointing and shouting above the roar. "We have to split up. Nothing's big enough for all of us."
Henry had located two recesses, each a few feet off the ground, alcoves scooped from the rock by thousands of years of waves. Neither was very deep, 4 or 5 feet at most. There were other, deeper nooks in the wall, but they were either too small or too high to reach without an arduous climb. Edgar nodded at Henry and trotted forward, Babu following at his heels, Essay and Tinder hanging back. The alcoves were separated by 40 feet or more. The leftmost was larger, but also higher and more difficult to reach. Edgar chose that one for himself and two of the dogs. He signed Tinder over to Henry, then turned to Babu.
"Up."
The dog looked at him, trying to make certain what Edgar wanted.
"Yes," he signed. "Up."
Then Babu crouched and sprang to the ledge. As soon as the dog landed, Edgar turned to Essay, who was backpedaling toward the water.
"Come,"
he signed to her.
"Up."
Essay shook off and retreated again, and Edgar ran to her.
"No games now," he signed. "Come on."
He put his hands under her belly and wheelbarrowed her forward. She twisted and mouthed his arms, then broke free and leapt to the ledge beside Babu. And the two dogs stood side by side looking at him. Behind them, the roof of the alcove was soot-blackened. Someone had once built a fire inside. The floor, eye-level for Edgar, had been swept clean by wind and water. He backed away, holding the dog's gaze, then looked over at Henry and Tinder, who were standing together in the sand.
"He won't let me lift him," Henry said. "He won't jump, and there's no other way up."
Edgar looked at the vacant hole in the rock. It was just big enough to fit a man and a dog. And Henry was right. Beneath the opening was a ledgeless rock face. There was no way Tinder could climb it. Edgar walked to Tinder and took the dog's head in his hand.
"You're going to have to try."
Henry scrambled onto the ledge while Edgar led Tinder back a few paces. Then Edgar ran forward and slapped his hand against the rock.
"Come on, Tinder,"
Henry cried.
"Try not to get us all killed."
At first, Tinder just stood there, panting and looking over his shoulder at the funnels roaring on the lake. The sound came from every direction now as the rock wall gathered it and echoed it back over the water. Twice, urged by Edgar and Henry and the barks of the other dogs, Tinder hobbled forward, but each time he drew up short and lowered his ears and looked at Edgar. Then Essay and Babu leapt down from their ledge and came running across the sand. Edgar caught Essay two-handed as she passed, but Babu kept running. When he reached Tinder, they touched noses, and then without delay, Babu wheeled and ran to the rock wall. Tinder didn't move. Babu backtracked, barked, and nosed him. And this time they ran forward together, Tinder limping badly. When they reached the rock wall, Tinder launched himself awkwardly into the air, yelping as he left the ground, his feet pedaling. He landed hard, back leg nearly off the ledge and kicking loose sand into the air. But Henry had him by his front legs, pulling him forward. Babu had sailed through the air beside him, but there was barely room for the three of them on the tiny ledge, and he jumped down at once. The roar from the lake penetrated every part of Edgar's body. He prodded Essay and Babu toward the other alcove, and they sprang up without hesitation. Edgar scrambled after them.
"Nat!"
came Henry's shout. Edgar looked across the rock wall. Henry knelt on the other ledge, hands cupped around his mouth.
"There's going to be a lake swell. Stay in the cave."
Then there was nothing more to say, and nothing Edgar could have heard over the wind. He turned back to the dogs. They were in a low, shallow scoop that narrowed rapidly into an egg-shaped cavity. Edgar had hoped to block the entrance with his body, but he saw at once that was impossible. At best, he might shield half the opening. He scuttled back, scraping his head on the sooty ceiling, and turned to face the lake. He signed Babu down across one leg and scissored him with the other. Then he downed Esse, who, to his amazement, complied, and he wrapped both arms around her. That was the best he could do. If they panicked, he could keep them in place, for a while at least, maybe long enough to calm them down. And then, backed into that cramped hole, they waited and looked out over the lake. Two of the waterspouts were close now, their sound a blast of every octave and pitch as they ground their way through the atmosphere. The closest stood a quarter of a mile out, like a cable dropped from the clouds into a ball of water vapor at the lake's surface. A fragment of cloud revolved along its shaft and vanished. Gobs of water splattered against the rocks, gulped out of Lake Superior and thrown landward. It made Edgar think of how his father stood in the doorway of the barn during thunderstorms, looking up at the sky. Even as he tried to pull the dogs farther back into the cave, Edgar wondered if his father would be doing the same thing now. As Henry predicted, the water began to rise. The spot where they first sighted the funnels was already submerged by the waves crashing ashore. The wind entered Edgar's nostrils and mouth, puffed out his cheeks, tried to lift the lids of his eyes. Sand and pebbles pelted them. He thought the sound and the wind might cow the dogs, but it didn't. The dogs permitted his hold on them, but never rolled back against him for reassurance. A gray chunk of driftwood began to roll end over end along the beach, come alive now and fleeing for its life. The dogs turned their muzzles to track it. Then the smallest of the funnels slid by, its bloom of water skimming the lake's surface like an upended rose. A jagged thread of light snaked down, drawn to a tree near the shoreline. The sound that followed was more like an explosion than thunder, but it was instantly swept away by the howling wind. When Edgar looked back at the lake, only the larger funnel remained. So squat and black, it looked as if the thing were drawing earth and sky together. What happened next took maybe 10 seconds. The ropey funnel that had just passed out of view reappeared, skipping and twisting across the water like a tentacle, moving back along its line of travel. Then the sinuous gray thread of its body was pulled toward the large funnel. They separated for a moment, then twined, the smaller of the two spiraling around the larger before it was consumed, or nearly so. A whirling steamer peeled away and flailed over the lake, dipping halfway to the water before evaporating. At the same time, the larger funnel changed from ashen to ghostly white, towering palely over the cove, lunging and retreating. Unbelievable, Edgar thought, as the wind buffeted them. What he was seeing was unbelievable. Yet he had seen unbelievable things before, came the answer, and he had run from them. That was the moment Esse decided to bolt. One instant, Edgar's arms were wrapped tightly around her chest. The next, she'd slipped away as effortlessly as if greased. She dashed across the cove, her bounds foreshortened by the wind. Babu barked and scrabbled his hind feet against the bare rock, but Edgar doubled over and threw his arms around the dog, clamping one hand over his muzzle to stop his thrashing. Almost at once he understood that Babu didn't intend to follow Esse. He wasn't drawn by her vision, her compulsion, whatever had made her race to meet the pillar that roared at them from out on the water. He was only trying to call Esse back. The white funnel lurched toward shore, 200 yards away now, maybe less, the distance from the Sawtell's house to the middle of the lower field. And there it came to a standstill, swaying over the lake. Esse faced it, barking and snarling, tail dropped like a scimitar. When she turned sideways, the force of the wind blew her hind feet out from under her, and she rolled twice, barrel-wise, before scrambling up and facing the wind squarely again, this time carefully holding her ground. Something crashed to the beach in front of the rocks, and a spray of blood pinked the air. An enormous fish of some kind, guts burst and streaming across the pebbled cove. Now Essay tried to advance. Each time she lifted a foot from the sand, her body wobbled precariously in the gale. Finally, it drove her to the ground. She lay there, ears flattened against her skull, muzzle wrinkled, legs extended like a hieroglyph of a dog. Stripped by the roar of the wind, it seemed to Edgar, to her essence. Insane and true all at the same time. When the wind abated for an instant, her hackles stood. Then it hit again, harder than ever. The trees along the shore whirled and bent and righted themselves, the breaking of their limbs like rifle cracks. "I should go out there," Edgar thought. "She's going to be killed. But then Babu will bolt." He had time to debate it in his mind, to weigh the loss of one against the other, and he saw there was no way to decide. She had made this choice, he thought. What his grandfather had always wanted, what he'd wished for time and again in his letters. So in the end, Edgar lay on the floor of the cave as the wind fired stones at them like bullets. He redoubled his grip on Babu and watched between his fingers as Essay was driven back to the tree line, crouching and retreating, her muzzle moving but no sound reaching them. And in that moment, he thought, it isn't going to work. I'll never get far enough away. I may as well never have left. Out on the lake, something changed. The funnel stalled, narrowed, whitened still more, then lifted off the water. The steam at its base dropped into the lake as if a spell had been broken. The stem of it writhed in the air above them like a snake suspended from the clouds. The wind lessened, and the blast of sound abated. Essay's bark came thinly to them, and Babu began to bark in response. From across the cove, Edgar heard Tinder doing the same. Overhead, the tube of wind slid sickeningly through the air, preparing to crash down again, this time directly on shore. But without pause, it revolved up into the clouds and disappeared, as if pursuing some tormentor there. A wash of foamy black water swept up from the lake, almost to the rock wall, then carried back with it half the water flooding the little cove. The freight train sound vanished. The wind gusted and was still. There was the hiss and boom of waves breaking up and down along the shore. The moment Edgar loosened his grip, Babu sprang from the ledge and ran to Essay, who was already trotting triumphantly before the retreating waves. Babu accompanied her for a few yards, then turned and bounded toward the rocks where Tinder and Henry huddled. And he paced there, waiting. Getting Tinder down was not easy. The rock was wet and slick, and Tinder resisted being carried. Henry took him in his arms and slid down, managing just enough grace to maintain his hold and scraping his back across the rocks in the process. When Henry set Tinder down on the wet sand, the dog limped to the wind-thrown fish and sniffed it. Drops of rain, real rain, not flung lake water, began to fall. Out on the lake, a huge mass of driftwood floated in the water like the tangled bones of a sailing ship dredged from the bottom. They found Henry's car plastered with green leaves. The passenger window sported a long white crack. They hustled the dogs inside and sat for a long time, breathing and listening to the patternless drum of rain on the roof. "There's something wrong with that dog," Henry said. "That wasn't hardly a sensible thing to do." Edgar nodded. But he thought, how can we know? He closed his eyes on the image of Ida Payne, bending toward him across her counter, filled his mind.
"If you go," she whispered, "don't you come back, not for nothing. It's just wind, that's all. Just wind. It don't mean nothing."
It don't mean nothing. He tried saying that to himself. He took up the paper and pencil lying on the seat. "Let's turn around," he wrote.
"Now that's more like it," Henry said.
He keyed the ignition and wheeled the car onto the road, facing the direction they had come.
"At least one of you is thinking straight."
Edgar smiled grimly, his face turned to watch the rain and the passing trees. If Henry knew the alternative, he thought, he'd like it even less. On the way back, Henry kept the radio off. He drove without comment, except for once when, apropos of nothing in the moment, he shook his head and muttered,
"Christ, all Friday."
It was steaming hot that next August afternoon, as Henry's car rolled along the forest road near Scotia Lake, where Edgar and the dogs had passed the 4th of July in what now seemed to him a time of aimless wandering. The water was hidden by the trees and foliage. From the inside of the car, it all looked unfamiliar. They overshot the driveway before Edgar caught sight of the little red cottage, now boarded up for the season. "Stop," he signed. "That was it."
"You sure?"
Edgar looked again and nodded. He recognized the white trim and the front door and the window he had crawled through. He remembered the taste of the chocolate bar he had stolen there, how it had melted in his back pocket while he fed the dogs butter squeezed through his fingers. Henry nosed his sedan into the weedy drive and killed the engine.
"I'm going to say this one last time," he said. "I can take you all the way to wherever you're going. I don't mind."
"Thanks," Edgar signed. "But no."
He knew Henry wanted him to elaborate. But what he wanted to do there at the lake, whom he hoped to find, what he hoped would result from it, required him to go on foot. He could think of no words to explain his hopes. Just as his mother had been unable to find words for the value of their dogs. They got out of the car, and he retrieved the fishing satchel and the Zebco from the trunk. He hooked the satchel's strap over his shoulder. The dogs nosed about until their curiosity was satisfied, then trotted back to the car, Tinder first, limping out of the underbrush, followed by Babu and Esse. Edgar knelt in front of Tinder and stroked his muzzle. He lifted, for the last time, his injured foot, to run his fingertips over the scarred pad. He watched Tinder for a flinch, but the dog only peered back at him. All the swelling was gone now, but his second toe still stood out. He set Tinder's foot down. Tinder lifted and presented it again.
"Stay,"
he signed. He did this out of habit and immediately wished to take it back, for it wasn't what he meant. He started to get up, then knelt again.
"Watch, Henry. He doesn't know much yet."
Then he stood and held out his hand, and Henry shook it.
"All you ever need to do is come back and ask," Henry said. "I'll take good care of him until then."
"No. He belongs with you. He chose."
And he had. Edgar could see it, as Tinder sat bright-eyed and panting, and leaning slightly against Henry's leg. He'd seen it in the car, driving back from Lake Superior, and later that night at Henry's house. It seemed to Edgar that Tinder was still making the leap onto that ledge to join Henry. And in one way or another, he would be making it every day for the rest of his life. Edgar turned and walked up the cabin driveway with Babu and Esse beside him. He let himself look back just once. Henry and Tinder stood by the car, watching them go. When they reached the lake, Babu noticed that Tinder wasn't following. He looked at Edgar, then wheeled and trotted back toward the car. Halfway there, he came to a halt. Edgar stopped and turned and slapped his leg. Babu came toward him a few steps, then looked over his shoulder at Henry and Tinder by the car and whined unhappily and sat. Edgar stood looking at the dog. He walked back and knelt in front of him. "You have to be sure," he signed. Babu peered at him, panting. He looked past Edgar's shoulder at Esse. After a long time, Babu stood, and together they trudged to the car. Babu bounded the last 20 feet and jumped into the back seat to join Tinder.
"It's not about me, is it?" Henry said. "He can't leave Tinder."
"No."
"You think I can do right by both of them?"
Edgar nodded.
"It's okay with me. Hell, more than okay."
Edgar stood looking at the two dogs for a long time, trying to fix the memory of them in his mind. Then Esse trotted up, and Babu jumped out to meet her. They circled end to end, as if they hadn't seen each other for a long time, and Babu lay his muzzle along her neck. Edgar turned and walked up the drive. He didn't give a recall or any other command. He couldn't bear to turn around. The underbrush whipped his face, but he hardly noticed it over the pounding in his head. He squeezed his eyes down to slits, but the tears leaked out anyway. Eventually, Esse appeared by his side. Then she bolted ahead and vanished into the underbrush. No more commands, he thought. Never again. She knew where they were as well as he, and she could run as she pleased. Behind them, Henry's car groaned to life. Despite himself, Edgar tracked the sound as it rolled along the road until, even standing still, only the forest sounds came to him.
Return. They spent that night on the spit of land where they had watched the fireworks, consumed by their own reflections, where the howling of the dogs had moved another watcher to announce himself. The next day they walked the perimeter of the lake, shady patches giving on to cattails and vast tracts of water lilies. Leopard frogs bounded into the water wherever they stepped. The fish were plentiful, the campers sparse. Most of the cabins had been shut down for the season, plywood nailed across their windows, and there was no point in forcing his way into them. Henry had supplied him with matches, fishhooks, and a small, gnarled, brown-handled pocket knife with ivory inlays. For each of the next 3 nights, they moved their camp a little farther into the low hills north of Scotia Lake. Esse adjusted to the solitary life more quickly than Edgar expected. At night, she and Edgar slept spooned together against the chilled air. She understood that they waited for something or someone. At times, she stood and paced, scenting for her two missing littermates. The days had grown shorter now. The August dusk began by 7 o'clock, night an hour after that. Late in the evening of the fourth night, when their small fire had burned down to embers, a pair of eyes glinted in the underbrush. Not deer or raccoon, whose eyes reflected the orange firelight as green. These eyes mirrored red when the flame was red, yellow when it was yellow, disappearing for an instant and then flickering back. Their possessor had approached from upwind, a habit, Edgar supposed, after all that time in the woods. He lay an arm across Essay's back. He'd saved a bit of fish, and he picked it up now and tossed it across the fire. Forte stepped out of the shadows.
He padded forward to sniff the offering. When Esse saw him, her body tensed, but Edgar asked her to stay with the pressure of his hand. It wasn't a command. He felt he hadn't the right anymore, that he had long ago fallen from grace, but only recently understood it. The stray's colors were just as Edgar remembered, amber and black across his back, his chest broad and blonde. One of his ears hung tattered from some fight long past, but his body had filled out, and his legs were thick and solid. Esse rumbled a warning in her throat, and Forte retreated into the dark. Edgar nursed the fire along late into the night, bent over the coals like a wizened old man, fatigued, though they had hardly done a thing all day. In the morning, Esse, too, was gone. She returned at noon, panting and covered with burrs. Edgar had already amassed a great number of fish. He fried the fish on sticks, and they gorged themselves. When Esse turned her nose away, he urged her to eat anyway. It was important she not want it later. He fished some more and cooked the fish, and thought of Henry sitting at the card table behind his house, roasting bratwurst, while he and the dogs looked on from their hiding place by the sunflowers. Blue evening reflected in the water. Starshot cirrus veils. Forte appeared again late that evening, and this time Esse trotted forward to meet him and scented his flanks while he stood rigidly waiting. Then she posed in return. When Forte left, much later, the pile of fish Edgar had set aside was gone. He began to fish again as soon as he woke the next day. He cooked the fish and stacked them up. Catcalls sounded from the woods around them. When they had eaten their fill, he stuffed the remainder into his satchel and left the Zebco lying on the ground, and they set out. The traveling was easy now. He didn't understand why it had taken so long to cross such a meager distance on the way out. In a single day, they covered a quarter of their return. Occasionally, he dropped a shred of cooked fish onto the ground as a trail. He wondered if he would recognize the route they'd taken all those weeks before. He did. Esse disappeared for an hour or more at times, but always he kept moving. Then there would be a rattle of bracken, and she would burst into a clearing and dash over to him, swiping her tail through the air. They came upon a familiar lake late in the day, and he built a small fire. He slept beside the dying embers as if trading them for dreams. He knew for certain that Forte was following, as he'd hoped, only on the second night. They'd walked all day, picking at the fish, a particle for himself, a particle for Esse, a particle tossed on the ground. Esse rooted for turtle eggs, but that season was past. A few stray blueberries hung on bushes, cooked in their skins. They stopped midday along a lake, and Edgar stripped and walked into the water, and stood until his skin cooled and the fresh mosquito bites stopped itching. An egret lifted out of the reeds near the lake's edge, white and archaic. It glided across the water and settled near the shore a safe distance away, and cawed its objection to his scaring the fish. But the egret was wrong. Edgar ate only the fish that remained in the satchel, reheating them over the fire. God, he was tired of eating them. He set the remainder of their cache near the edge of the firelight. He suspected it was a bad idea. The satchel was greasy from the fat and the bodies of the fish. Perhaps every bear in the region knew where they were by now. But so would Forte, and he was right about that. When he woke in the morning, the stray raised his muzzle and gazed at him over the glowing char of the fire. He lay still. Esse stood and circled to Forte and nosed him, and both dogs circled back. Forte extended his neck and scented him, legs trembling. He stroked Esse under the chin, and then his hand passed to Forte. When he stood, the dog backpedaled. With his one shredded ear, he looked at once comical and cagey. Edgar turned his back and gathered his things. When he looked around, Forte was gone, as was Esse. Now Amandine occupied his thoughts. He hadn't seen her for 2 months or more, and suddenly it felt like he'd been severed from some fundament of his being. At the end of the next day, or the day after that, they would be joined again. Perhaps she would have forgotten his crimes, for which he wanted more than anything to atone. Everything that had happened to him since he'd left made him think of her. Others dreamed of finding a person in the world whose soul was made in their mirror image. But she and Edgar had been conceived nearly together, grown up together, and however strange it might be, she was his other. Much could be endured for that. He also knew that she was old, and he had squandered some portion of their time circling in the woods, blind, confused, stopping and starting with only vague notions of what to do. Without the strangest kind of intercession, he might never have seen her again. Perhaps only when he'd become an old man would he realize how reduced he'd been by that decision, how withered he'd become, away from her. He'd left in confusion, but his return was clarifying. So much of what had been obscure while he faced away was now evident. No sooner had he walked away from that cove by the lake than the need to go home possessed him. He understood the rightness of Tinder's decision, and Babu's. Henry was a fretful person, filled with doubts and worries, but he was faithful as well. Edgar wondered what would have happened to them if Tinder had injured his foot a mile farther along. So much of the world was governed by chance. If they had left Henry's house a day earlier, they might have been in Canada that very moment, maybe even at Starchild Colony. Life was a swarm of accidents waiting in the treetops, descending upon any living thing that passed, ready to eat them alive. You swam in a river of chance and coincidence. You clung to the happiest accidents. The rest you let float by. You met a good man in whose care a dog would be safe. You looked around and discovered the most unusual thing in the world sitting there looking at you. Some things were certain. They had already happened, but the future could not be divined. Perhaps by Ida Payne. For everyone else, the future was no ally. A person had only his life to barter with. He felt that way. He could lose himself to Starchild Colony, or trade what he held for something he cared about. That rare thing. Either way, his life would be spent. These were his thoughts as he walked the edge of a marshy clearing. Across the way, Esse bounded and turned and nipped at Forte, who followed her, suddenly awkward and puppy-like. At length, from Forte's ineptitude and lurching clumsiness, a fight broke out between them. But it was a mock battle, and soon Esse gallivanted over to Edgar, ignoring the lout. They slept far from water or any landmark familiar to him. He made a fire for warmth and let it bank. Forte lay watching, curled beneath a chestnut sapling. That night Edgar crossed the lighted circle to sit near the stray and work the burrs out of his coat. When he finished, he stroked the animal along his withers. Forte scented his wrist. He remembered those nights in the garden, Forte silvered in the moonlight and quivering beneath his hands. Then Edgar returned to his side of the fire. His last thought before he slept was that he was glad not to be eating fish, even if it meant going hungry. The next morning they set off eastward, tracing shadows back to their source again and again. Esse and Forte disappeared. When he saw Esse again, her muzzle was stained red with fresh blood. He knelt beside her and ran his fingers along her gum line and ruff and legs, but the blood wasn't hers. Forte was nowhere to be seen. They came to the clearing filled with fire-scarred trees where they had stopped the very first night, where the owls had turned to watch them. He began to run. The sumac blazed red where earlier it had stood like green parasols. When he looked down, Esse was by his side. The old logging trail appeared. They came to the fence line set in the middle of the creek. The water was no more than a trickle, and the fence post, he'd uprooted, sat cockeyed in the silt and dirt. He stepped into the water and lifted the barbed wire. Esse passed beneath, almost without breaking stride. On the far side, she shook herself needlessly and waited. The creek water slipped over the sand and rocks. He stood waiting for Forte. After a time, he decided the dog would find his own way to cross, if he was going to cross at all. He pushed the fence post over and stepped across the wires, not bothering to restore it, as he walked back onto their land. Almandine. When she wasn't sleeping already, she lay in the shade and waited for sleep to return. In slumber, everything was as it had once been. When they were whole, and he ran beside her, pink and small-limbed and clumsy. Those were nights when the timbers of the house had breathed for them, and no sand had yet worked into her joints. No search for him was necessary. In her dreams, he was there, always, waving bachelor's buttons for her to smell, unearthing oddities she was required to dig from his clenched hands for fear he'd found some dangerous thing. Not so in the waking world, which held nothing but an endless search. All her life she had found whatever she'd been asked to find, and there had only been one thing ever. Now he was truly lost, gone away, crossed into another world, perhaps, some land unknown to her, from which he could not return. The closet was as puzzled as she, the bed silent on the question. It was not out of the question that he had learned the secret of flight, and the window was not too small for him to pass through. There, sleeping on his bed at night, she would be the first to see when he returned. Old as she was, she still had questions to ask him, things to show him. She worried about him. She needed to find him, whole or changed, but no, in any case, and she would taste the salt of his neck. She had learned in her life that time lived inside you. You are time. You breathe time. When she'd been young, she'd had an insatiable hunger for more of it, though she hadn't understood why. Now she held inside her a cacophony of times, and lately it drowned out the world. The apple tree was still nice to lie near, the peony, for its scent, also fine. When she walked through the woods, infrequently now, she picked her way along the path, making way for the boy inside to run along before her. It could be hard to choose the time outside over the time within. There was still work to do, of course. The young ones in the barn knew so little, and she had taught so many before. It hardly seemed worth trying when she was asked, though she did. She slowed. The farm danced about her. The apple trees bickered with the wind, clasped limbs in union against it. Blackbirds and sparrows and chickadees and owls rimming their crowns. The garden cried out its green infant odor, its melange, the invention of deer, or, now it seemed to her, the other way around. The barn swung her fat shadow across the yard, holding it gently by dark wrists and letting it turn, turn, stretch out in the evening upon the ground, but never slip. Faster it all revolved around her when she closed her eyes. Clouds rumbled across heaven, and she lay beneath, and in the passage of shadow and yellow sunlight, the house murmured secrets to the truck, the traveler, who listened for only so long before its devout empiricism forced it away, in wide-eyed panic, to test such ideas among its fellows. The maple tree held the wash up to the light in supplication, and received bright flames, yellow jackets each day, its only reply. The mailbox stood soldierly by the road, capturing a man and releasing him again and again. Among them, the woman passed, oblivious to it all, leading the pups once more through what they surely must already have learned. The foolish pups who made them all stop and watch, such was their power. Almandine sat and watched them, and then, somehow, the boy would be sitting beside her, arm across her withers. The pups had so little time inside them, they barely stayed attached to the ground. As it had been with her, she supposed. And then she turned her head and looked, and Edgar was missing all over again. Had he really been there? Had it only been some bit of time inside her? The answer mattered more and more, even as the power in her to find him ebbed. They'd shaped each other under the heat of some more brilliant sun, whose light had quietly passed from the world. The towering pines in the front yard knew it. They suffocated one night when an ocean mist drifted into the yard, though no one noticed but she. 3 days she lay beneath them, mourning. The squirrels, respectful of nothing, ransacked the carcasses. The nights grew darker, the stars distracted. She slept beside his bed because, if nowhere else, he would return there. He had been tricking her. He had hidden so cleverly. What a reunion they would have when he stepped out of his hiding place. How they would laugh. What joy there would be. The greatest trick of all revealed by him, there all along, and watching while she searched. All along. The thought was so startling, she rose and panted and shook her head. So many places worthy of another look. But empty, all of them. And all extracting their penalty. Impassive, blithe, unconcerned. And then, mid-morning of a day, when the sky rang overhead, she reached a decision. She rose from her sleeping spot in the living room. In the kitchen, she set her long, soft jaw on the woman's leg and tried to make it clear she would have to look elsewhere. The woman stroked her absently, a hand familiar against her flanks and caressing behind her ears. Almandine was grateful for it. The door stood unlatched. She still had the strength to pull it open. She walked between the rows of trees on the long slope of the orchard and waited near the topmost tree. Perhaps he traveled. Now she would, too. From far away, she heard the traveler coming. For as long as she could remember, they'd passed her yard, acquaintances of the truck, exchangers of the empirical, the factual, the mathematical, traders in unknown quantities, longitudes and azimuths, secants and triangulations. She had thought them intruders when she was young, but learned to pay no attention, her alarm foolish. They were benign, careening about for reasons of their own. Unstealthy, broad, and stupid they were, but they saw a lot of the world. It was coming up the far side of the hill. Its cloud of dust filled the air between the trees. The glint of its front piece appeared. She wasn't scared. One must try new things. Inside, she held the image of him on that first morning, awake in his mother's sleeping arms. She'd thought what had begun then would never end. Yet he'd been too long missing for things to be wholly right. Nothing new of him in the yard. Nothing in the house. all of it forgetting. Slowly, slowly, she could feel it. And one could last only so long, separated from the essence. A quest waited in those circumstances, always. The traveler was almost there. If this one knew nothing, she would ask the next, and the next. One of them would know. She had asked the truck her question, but with silence it professed ignorance. It hadn't carried him lately, though it would not deny it had carried him many times before. She had never thought to ask the other travelers until that morning. The idea had come to her in a whisper. She stepped onto the sharp red gravel of the road. She was very nearly not there at all, so deeply was she inside her own mind. There was a time in her when he had fallen from an apple tree, a tree she'd just stepped away from. He'd landed with a thump on his back. A time in the winter when he'd piled the snow on her face until the world had gone white and she dug for his mittened hand. Inside her were countless mornings watching his eyes flutter open as he woke. Above all, she recalled the language the two of them had invented, a language in which everything important could be said. She did not know how to ask the traveler what she needed to ask, nor what form its reply might take. But it was upon her now, angry and rushed, and it wouldn't be long before she knew the answer. A bloom of dust, like a thundercloud, chased it down the hill. She stood broadside in the gravel and turned her head and asked her question. Asked if it had seen her boy, her essence, her soul. But if the traveler understood, it showed no sign.
Part 5. Poison. Edgar. They walked up through the mantle of tree shadow, stretching across the western field. Ahead, the red siding of the barn glowed, phosphorescent in the mulled sunset. A pair of does sprang over the fence on the north side of the field, two leaps each, nonchalant, long-sustained, falling earthward only as an afterthought, and crashed through the hazel and sumac. The air was still and hot, and the hay rasped dryly at Edgar's legs. Stalks of wild corn dotted the field, leaves frayed and bitten to the cane, and the Indian tobacco was brown and wilted from the heat, all of it brittle and rattling, as if folded from the sheets of cigarette paper. By the time Edgar reached the rock pile, Essay had already coursed the yard, whipping the kennel dogs into a frenzy. He perched on a rock and listened. Equal parts of longing and dread washed through him. But the sound of the dogs pleased him, the way a lullaby might please an old man. He picked out their voices one by one and named them. From where he sat, he could see only the roof of the house, hovering darkly over the yard. He waited for some human figure to appear, but there was only the flash of Essay's body, low and elongate, cutting through the grass as she made another round. He stood and walked the rest of the way. The house was dark. The impala sat parked in the grass. In the garden he could see the green tract of cucumber and pumpkin vines, and far back by the woods a half-dozen sunflowers leaning bent-headed over it all. He peered through the living room windows, hoping to see Almandine, knowing all the while that had she been home, she would already have found some way to bolt from the house. When he entered the barn, the dogs braced their forepaws on their pen doors and greeted him with yodels and roars and howls. He went from pen to pen, letting them jump and claw his shirt, laughing at their mad dashes and play bows and rolls. He saved Pout and Finch and Opal and Umbra for last. He knelt and mouthed their names into their ears, and they washed his face with their tongues. When they had quieted, he found a coffee can and dished kibble into a pile for Essay. She started eating daintily, then leaned into it, as if suddenly remembering food. Two pups greeted him in the nursery. Just two, from the litter of eight whelped before he left. They were weaned and fat, shaking their bellies and beating their tails. He squatted and scratched their chins. "What did they name you? Where are the others?" He walked to the workshop. He looked at the file cabinets and the books arranged atop them. The new Webster Encyclopedic Dictionary of the English language weighed so little in his hands. The scent of its pages like road dust. He leaned against the wall and thought of his grandfather and of Brooks's never-ending admonitions. And he thought of Hachiko. Among the mishmash of correspondence, he found the letter from Tokyo and withdrew the crumpled photograph he'd hidden there. He looked at Claude and Forte through the webwork of cracks in the emulsion, then slid it into his pocket. He closed up the kennel and walked to the house. The kitchen door key hung from a nail in the basement. He ate straight from the refrigerator, fog pouring over his feet. Bread and cheese and roast chicken off the bone. Then walked through the house, cradling a 5-quart bucket of vanilla ice cream under his arm, spooning it up and looking around. The kitchen clock, the stove, the candle nightlight, the living room furniture sitting petrified and ogre-like in the dusk, the clothes hanging in his mother's closet. He walked up the stairs and sat on his bed, a puff of dust lifted into the air. Across the plank flooring, dead flies lay scattered, dry husks, blue and green, with cellophaned wings. He hadn't imagined everyone would be gone. He hadn't imagined saying hello to the place before seeing his mother, before seeing Almandine most of all. He had imagined sleeping in that bed again, but looking at it now, he didn't know how he could. He put the ice cream back in the freezer and dropped the spoon into the sink. Essay scratched at the porch door. He walked out and pushed the door open and let her trot through the house, repeating his inspection. He was seated at the table at his father's place when she returned. He sat for a long time, waiting. It was hard for him not to think about what things would be like. Finally, he decided to wash up. When he lifted his face from the towel in the bathroom, he saw the green soap turtle sitting on the windowsill, complete and perfect except for one shriveled hind foot. He walked into the kitchen and found a pencil and a scrap of paper, and touched the lead of the paper and stopped, and looked out the kitchen windows. The windows had been propped open on sticks, and a night breeze, hot as an animal exhalation, ruffled the gingham curtains. Dark, ripe apples swung from the branches outside the window. He put the pencil to the paper again. "I ate while you were gone," he wrote. "I'll come back tomorrow." Then he took the photograph of Claude and Forte from his pocket and set it beside the note. He gave Essay the option of staying or coming along. She walked down the porch steps, calm now, curiosity satisfied. He pocketed the key and stood trying to decide where to sleep. The mow on a night that hot would be stifling. In the milk house, he found a pile of burlap sacks. They walked into the field. It was full dark by that time, but the faint reach of the yard light cast his shadow before him. At the narrow end of the trees by the whale rock, he snapped the dust from the sacks and threw them down. Essay circled and circled, solving again the everlasting riddle of lying down to sleep. She came to rest with her back to him, muzzle fitted high on her foreleg. Overhead the aurora flew, sheets of wild neon. He focused on the hovering seed of the yard light, flickering through the hay, and breathed the scent of pollen and decay that infused the night. They'd slept for some time when the truck crested the hill. The moon was up, the field around them like salt and silver. He sat on the burlap and watched the truck back around and stop by the porch while the kennel dogs barked a frantic greeting. Esse stood and whined. Edgar lay a hand on her hip. She nosed him and turned back to watch. The truck disgorged the figures of Claude and his mother. Claude lifted the gate on the topper and lifted out two bags of groceries while his mother paused to settle the dogs. The porch door creaked and slapped. The kitchen light appeared dimly through the broad windows in the living room. Twice more, Claude walked between the back porch and the truck. On his last trip, he stood looking around the yard, then closed the topper and walked to the porch and turned out the light. And sitting under the stars and the sky, Edgar waited to see Almandine. She hadn't jumped down from the bed of the truck. He had watched for that. "I just missed her," he said to himself. He closed his eyes to see it again. But she would have scented him at once. He felt himself perfectly drawn and repelled, wishing to be done with that part of his life, and wishing never to let it end, knowing that whatever came next would only reduce what had already happened until there was nothing but memory, a story eroded, a dream thinly recalled. If she wasn't at home, then she must have gone into town with them. It was one or the other. One or the other. He looked at the stand of birches, alone, in the center of the field. It was the middle of August, and when he stood, the timothy almost reached his waist. He stumbled through it, striking at the heads with his splayed hands. The trunks of the birches tilted and blurred, and the leaves in their canopy quavered whitely. Then he was standing in the broad circle of grass, scythed away at the base of the trees. There was the familiar white cross for the stillborn baby, and the newer one for his father. And next to them, as yet unmarked, an oblong of fresh, dark ground. It blew the breath out of him. He fell like a puppet severed from its strings. He lay with his forehead pressed to the ground, the scent of iron and loam filling his nostrils, and he clutched the dirt and poured it out of his hands. An oceanic roar filled his head. All his memory, all his past, rose up to engulf him. Images of Almandine. How she liked peanut butter, but not peanuts. How she preferred lima beans to corn, but refused peas. How, best of all, she adored honey, any way she could get it. Licked from his fingers, from his lips, dabbed on her nose. How she liked to snatch things from his hands and let him take them back. How, if he cupped her chin, she would lower and lower her head all the way to the ground to stay like that. How different it was to stroke her with his palm than with his fingertips. How he could lay a hand on her side while she slept, and she wouldn't open her eyes, but nonetheless understood.